From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, search and rescue efforts continue 8 days after the quake in Nepal. National Guard troops are withdrawing from riot-torn Baltimore.
It's been a really rough week, but let's get back to normal in the city and get people back to work and back to school and get people coming back into the city.
Police killed two gunmen outside a Mohammed cartoon event in Texas. And Australian police defend the Bali 9 investigation. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Four more people have been rescued from underneath rubble days after the April 25th earthquake in Nepal. Nepalese officials say more than 7,000 people have died and thousands are missing. The victims were remembered during a vigil in Kathmandu over the weekend. Lila Shrestha is a resident of the capital.
We are praying for those who passed away in the earthquake and wanted to light candles to commemorate those who were,
Thousands of survivors are urging the government to move more quickly to provide essentials such as food and water to people displaced by the quake. Those distributing the aid are also appealing for more help as well. Arathan Cousin is executive director of the World Food Program. She is in Nepal.
We definitely need more helicopters. This is an area where, particularly in these early days of the response, and even 7 days in, this is still very much considered the early days, because there are people who we haven't yet reached. So we need helicopters in order to reach them.
UN Humanitarian Affairs Chief Valerie Amos met with Nepalese officials after visiting devastated areas there, later telling reporters that emergency funding for relief efforts was streaming into the country and urging the international community to increase its support. The World Health Organization and its partners are among the groups in Nepal to help the people recover from the quake. Paul Garwood is with the WHO in Kathmandu, and he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the crisis.
In terms of health, the earthquake has had a major impact on health facilities in the country of Nepal. It's displaced many people, so put them in precarious conditions health-wise. And it's caused, of course, the need for there to be a huge influx of national, international aid in terms of medical supplies and medical professionals to respond to the great health needs. And these health needs, they include treating the many injured people. More than 14,000 people are estimated to have been injured in this emergency, including many people with broken bones, fractures, crush syndrome, as well as the displacement of people has put them at great risk of contracting communicable diseases such as diarrheal diseases and acute respiratory infections. So the main health concerns that we see are these, along with the disruption and often the damage and in some cases destruction of hospitals and clinics and other health facilities in the most affected districts of the country.
So what is the WHO and its partners doing to try to deal with these problems?
Well, one thing we're doing is coordinating, bringing together health professionals from all over the world, whether they be foreign medical teams, expert in emergency response to these kinds of health emergencies, and non-governmental organizations, expert in delivering health care in humanitarian situations. We brought them together as part of the Foreign Medical Team Initiative and the Health Cluster Initiative. And so we're trying to ensure that healthcare is as available and widely available in as many locations as possible. So that coordination role is key, always in support of the government here of Nepal. Bringing in medical supplies is a key role that WHO is playing. At the moment, we've brought in medical supplies that could treat more than 120,000 people for the next 3 months, and more supplies are arriving in Kathmandu. We'll see extra diarrheal disease medicines brought in along with other equipment, including medical tents. Another key thing we're doing is keeping a close eye on the health situation in general. WHO issued its first rapid health assessment within the first week of the earthquake. It's been a major undertaking where WHO staff and Ministry of Health staff have gone into all the main affected districts of the country to assess how badly the health system has been affected and how well those hospitals and clinics that are still standing are functioning. And we had some great results. We saw that in many districts there is still a functioning health system, whether it's at clinic level or hospital level. We see that the government has sufficient aid in terms of medical staff available to deliver the care needed. So there's abundant medical professionals from the country and from internationally who are here in Nepal to help. The main need the government of Nepal has in these medical facilities to have continuing medical supplies, replenishment of supplies, IV fluids, diarrheal disease medicines, insulin, all essential emergency medicines plus medicines needed for routine care. So WHO's role is to ensure the continual stocking of that medical supply chain to ensure that hospitals and clinics around the country are able to continue treating people.
Paul Garwood is with the World Health Organization in Nepal's capital, Kathmandu. The mayor of the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore, Maryland, Sunday lifted a nighttime curfew put in place following the death of a 25-year-old African-American man while in police custody. BOA's Victor Beatty reports the decision came 2 days after the city's chief prosecutor announced she was bringing criminal charges against six policemen for involvement in the death of Freddie Gray.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake said on Twitter her goal has always been to not have the curfew in place a single day longer than was necessary, adding she believes that point was reached on Sunday. The 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew put in place last Tuesday was to have originally ended on Monday. Parts of the port city of more than 620,000 exploded in violence after Gray's funeral April 27th. The Baltimore State's Attorney's Office has charged six officers involved in Gray's arrest April 12, three of them black, with crimes ranging from manslaughter to murder. Gray died a week later from a severe spinal cord injury. Prosecutors say he was arrested for no reason and that officers ignored his pleas for medical help. The police union says it will fight the charges. Appearing Sunday on the NBC program Meet the Press, Rawlings Blake said the community has told her it wants to get back to normal. She says she's now hopeful in the wake of days of peaceful protests.
Everyone wants to have that sense of peace and calm back in our city so we can begin to heal. And that's going to be my focus for this week.
Police Sunday said nearly 500 people have been arrested since April 23rd. And the mayor vowed that those responsible for the looting and burning of private property are being identified and will be prosecuted. Last week, the mayor was quoted as saying she instructed police to do everything they could to make sure the protesters were able to exercise their right to free speech. She also said she wanted to give those who wished to destroy space to do so. Sunday, she was asked if she regretted the comment.
I certainly used the wrong phrase to talk about what was clear, that there were people who took advantage of the peaceful demonstrators' First Amendment rights, and they used it to destroy our city. And I don't condone it, and we'll make sure that those individuals will be held accountable.
Maryland State Governor Larry Hogan Sunday acknowledged it will take some time to get back to normal, but called the decision to lift the curfew a good idea.
It's been a really rough week, but let's get back to normal in the city and get people back to work and back to school and get people coming back into the city to visit the shops that were really devastated this week, and the smallest mom-and-pop stores and restaurants, they need your help. So we want to encourage everybody to come back to the city. It's safe, and we've got calm and peace in the city.
About 4,000 Maryland National Guard troops and extra police from outside Baltimore deployed last week to bolster the city's police force are being withdrawn, a process that could take a few days. Meanwhile, Gray family attorney William Billy Murphy told Fox News Sunday they are prepared to accept the verdict of a fair and impartial jury of 12 men and women selected from within the city to determine whether the officers involved in Gray's arrest should be prosecuted. He says the family simply wants justice. Murphy says the problems facing the city's black community are deeper than just the Gray case.
These are children who have been neglected. They don't have parents because mainly the war on drugs is a war on black people who are suspected of having drugs. And whites in this town, just like in major cities across the country, who have the same amount of illegal drugs, except they use them discreetly, don't get prosecuted. They're about 91-92% of the cases in Baltimore City, probably more, where only blacks and browns are prosecuted for drugs. That has to be addressed.
Murphy says the war on drugs has been a failure and results in the over-incarceration of black men who otherwise could be fathers and destroys black families. Congressman Elijah Cummings, whose West Baltimore district was at the heart of the protests, told ABC's This Week program Sunday, a lot of young people feel disconnected from society.
And we have to have what I call an inclusion revolution and address issues such as joblessness and training for young people. And we also have to look at our police department very carefully. We need to have a up and down look at it. and be honest and address it in an effective way.
Cummings says he will ask President Obama to send a bipartisan delegation to look at what is going on in Baltimore. He says it is symbolic of what's going on all over the country. Protests erupted in the St. Louis, Missouri suburb of Ferguson last August after black teenager Michael Brown was killed in an altercation with a white police officer. In December, protests broke out following the decision of a grand jury to drop criminal charges against a white New York City policeman whose chokehold led to the death of 43-year-old African-American Eric Garner. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Police in Garland, Texas, a Dallas suburb, shot and killed two men who they said began shooting at a security officer outside a building where a free speech event was taking place Sunday. The event included a contest for cartoons of Islam's Prophet Muhammad, a visual representation of whom is considered blasphemous by many devout Muslims. VOA's Greg Flakus has more on the story from our Houston bureau.
Officials said police were on hand and responded quickly when a car drove up outside the arena where the event was taking place, and two men began firing weapons at the security officer outside. In the exchange of gunfire, police say both alleged attackers died and the security officer suffered non-life-threatening wounds. The bodies of the two men remained by the vehicle long after the shooting as police brought in a robotic device and explosive experts to check the car. Garland Police Department spokesman Joe Harn told reporters on the scene that police have just started their investigation of the incident.
The only things that we know right now is that they drove up, got out, and opened fire on the security officer. Don't have any idea at this time who they are.
A wide area around the crime scene has been blocked off by police as they proceed slowly and cautiously to inspect the vehicle used by the gunman. Harn says they have no indication of explosives being in the car, but they're taking no chances.
It's a matter of precaution because of what happened and what has happened at other events involving these people. We're taking every precaution that we can. We evacuated businesses that were close by. We evacuated the event center by putting people in Garland school buses and taking them away from that area.
The New York-based American Freedom Defense Initiative sponsored the event, which included an awards ceremony for cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. The organization's president, Pamela Geller, described the shooting as a terrorist attack on her website, saying, "This is a war on free speech." Geller is known for her efforts to block the opening of an Islamic center near the site of the World Trade Center towers that were brought down in the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. In Europe, a number of cartoonists who drew pictures of the Prophet Muhammad for a Danish publication in 2005 went into hiding after receiving threats. In January, gunmen killed 12 people at the Paris offices of Charlie Hebdo, a satirical French magazine that had printed such cartoons. But while the circumstances might suggest a connection between the shooting Sunday and the event taking place, police say they have not yet found any evidence of a motive. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Houston.
The Australian Federal Police has defended its cooperation with Indonesia in the case of two drug traffickers who were executed by firing squad last week. Australians Muran Sukumaran and Andrew Chan were part of a trafficking gang known as the Bali Nine and were sentenced to death for their part in a conspiracy to smuggle heroin a decade ago. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Australian Federal Police, the AFP, held a news conference Monday to set the record straight over the Bali Nine. The group of young Australians was arrested trying to smuggle more than 8 kilograms of heroin from the Indonesia holiday island of Bali to Sydney in 2005. Seven members of the gang are serving long jail terms, while the ringleaders Andrew Chan and Myron Sukumaran were executed in Indonesia last week. The AFP has denied accusations that it has blood on its hands over its cooperation with Indonesia on the Bali Nine. Senior officers have conceded they knew their actions a decade ago could expose individuals to the death penalty. They've stressed they have no reason to apologise for trying to stop the flow of illicit drugs into Australia. Critics have insisted the gang could have been arrested before leaving Australia, but AFP Commissioner Andrew Colvin said there was insufficient evidence to detain them. Although the force's guidelines have been changed, Colvin has warned that investigations in the future could result in Australians facing the death penalty overseas.
It's a hard reality that many of these countries still have the death penalty for serious offences. For this reason, we cannot limit our cooperation just to those countries that have a similar judicial system or similar policies to that of our own. We must be able to work effectively with those countries that are closest to us when you consider the region that we are a part of. Now, on the key question of could this happen again, I wish I could assure you that this scenario could never happen again, but I cannot.
Supporters of Andrew Chan and Myuran Sukumaran said they'd been rehabilitated and had become role models for other prisoners. Chan had become a Christian pastor behind bars and Sukumaran an accomplished artist. They were executed last week, along with condemned inmates from Brazil and Nigeria, prompting international outrage. Australia has withdrawn its ambassador in protest. Indonesia has said the executions were part of its response to what it's called a drugs emergency. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This week could decide the fate of a bipartisan bill allowing the U.S. Congress to review and vote on any final nuclear accord with Iran. All eyes are on the Senate, which can either vote on the original bill or allow amendments making additional demands of Iran. VOA's Michael Bowman reports alterations would trigger a presidential veto and could doom the entire legislative effort.
If enacted, the bill would freeze U.S. sanctions relief on Iran for 30 days while Congress reviews a final nuclear pact with Tehran. It has the strong backing of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
These sanctions are a big reason why America was able to even bring Iran to the table in the first place. We shouldn't be giving up that leverage now without the American people, through the members of Congress they elect, having a chance to weigh in. Quite simple.
But some of the very Republicans he leads are putting McConnell in a tough position, doing everything in their power to force votes on amendments on side issues to the nuclear talks, like compelling Tehran to recognize Israel's right to exist. Senator Tom Cotton is unapologetic in pressing for so-called poison pill amendments that could derail the bill.
We need to vote. If you don't want to vote, you shouldn't have come to the Senate. If you're in the Senate and you don't want to vote, you should leave. We are talking about a nuclear-armed Iran, the most dangerous threat to our national security.
President Barack Obama says the chance to verifiably limit Iran's nuclear ambitions must not be squandered by airing America's many grievances with Tehran. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Meetings between Syria's warring factions and the UN's Syrian envoy begin this week in the latest bid to kickstart stalled negotiations to end the country's four-year-old civil war. Lisa Schlein has details from the UN site in Geneva.
UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura will hold separate in-depth consultations with each of the parties on the dire situation in Syria. UN spokesman Ahmed Fawzi says de Mistura will take stock of their views on reopening peace talks based on the 2012 so-called Geneva communique. One of the points in this accord involves a commitment to form a transitional government. Fawzi tells VOA the list of participants invited is large and all-inclusive.
Everybody involved in the Syria tragedy, whether they're regional players, whether they're neighbors, whether they're P5 members, are invited. We're starting, or the special envoy, of course, is starting with the Syrians, both government and opposition. And we'll also be meeting the stakeholders I just mentioned, regional and international, separately. Low-key, low-profile.
Invitees reportedly include the United States, Russia, Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. However, Fawzi notes the militant groups Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra have not been invited because they are classified as terrorist organizations. But he adds people who have relationships with these groups and can communicate with them will be at the meeting. The talks are not off to an auspicious start. They follow two previous rounds of failed peace talks, Geneva 1 and 2. Stefan de Mistura is the third special envoy to tackle this intractable global conflict. He faces an even more daunting task than his predecessors in his reach for a political solution. If anything, the political climate and catastrophic humanitarian situation has gotten worse. As Syria enters its fifth year of war, international agencies report more than 220,000 people have been killed and more than half the country's population of 22 million is displaced both within and outside the country. While some diplomats are skeptical about de Mistura's chance of success, Russia reportedly has said it hopes the talks will lead to a united front against terrorism, followed by a political transition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said he would be willing to talk with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to help broker an end to the civil war. Ahmed Fawzi says no major announcements are expected at the end of these consultations.
We don't expect any concluding communiques that will be signed by everybody. There will be no final curtain call. When he thinks he's finished the process, and we said initially 5 to 6 weeks, he will sit down, assess progress, if any, and then report to the Secretary General with his assessment and his recommendation.
Fawzi says the closed-door talks will officially begin Tuesday afternoon. He says the special envoy and his deputy will meet each party separately anywhere from 1 to 6 hours or longer. He says there are no time limits to these private, open-ended talks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the run-up to World Press Freedom Day, the Department of State highlighted the cases of several journalists around the world who are being silenced because they exercise their fundamental right to free expression and spoke truth to power. From Syria, the State Department cited the imprisonment of three important human rights and free expression activists who remain imprisoned by the brutal regime of President Bashar al-Assad, Mazen Darwish, Hana Zitani, and Hussein Kargir. Mazen Darwish is the director of the Syrian Center for Media and Freedom of Expression, a non-governmental organization he founded that specializes in promoting freedom of expression and that also played a key role in disseminating information about daily developments in Syria, including the atrocities committed by the Assad regime. Mr. Darwish and his two colleagues were arrested at their office by regime security forces in February 2012. The three men were held for 2 years without charge and an additional year without trial after charges were filed. Their trial on the spurious charge of promoting terrorist acts has been postponed 22 times. The prison conditions in Syria are abominable, with torture and abuse rampant in regime-run detention centers, as has been well documented, including by the 55,000 photographs smuggled out of the country in 2013 by a former Syrian army photographer who goes by the alias Caesar. U.S. State Department acting spokesperson Marie Harf called for the immediate release of Mazen Darwish, Hani Zitani, and Hussein Kargir, arrested and detained for exercising their human rights. She also called on the Assad regime to release all arbitrarily detained journalists and political prisoners who are currently suffering horrific conditions and are at risk of abuse and torture in the prisons.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.